a day of mourning and strike in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin after three Palestinians die in Israeli violence. Ukraine says Russia has carried out a missile attack on Kyiv, targeting critical infrastructure there. And Peruvian President Dina Boluarte says she will not step down, defying demands by protesters over recent weeks. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Israeli crimes show no signs of letting up as regime forces kill another two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Two Palestinians were shot dead during an Israeli raid on a village near the city of Jenin, and they were traveling in a car when Israeli forces opened fire on them. One of them was killed on the spot, the other later died of his injuries. Also on Saturday, another Palestinian succumbed to wounds he sustained during an Israeli raid near Jenin earlier this month. A day of public mourning and a citywide strike has been declared in Jenin. Latest deaths bring to 12 number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank since the beginning of the year. The Israeli regime stepped up attacks in the occupied territories over the past several months. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amiri Abdollahian has concluded a two-day visit to Lebanon, where talks with the country's top officials. Both sides stressed the significance of implementing bilateral agreements, while the Lebanese foreign minister declared that foreign pressure is preventing the Arab country from acquiring much-needed assistance from Tehran.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian held talks Friday in Beirut with top-ranking Lebanese officials. The Iranian official said in a joint presser with his Lebanese counterpart that Iran wishes to see problems and difficulties go away in Lebanon, reiterating a previous offer to help resolve Lebanon's electricity crisis.
We would like to officially stress once more that the Islamic Republic of Iran is fully ready, with its advanced scientific, engineering, and technical expertise, to rehabilitate the power plants in Lebanon and even build new plants if needed, on the condition that there is consensus on this matter.
Lebanese Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib revealed that foreign pressure exerted against Lebanon as well as internal disputes have been obstacles in the way of acquiring assistance from Iran. Lebanon and Iran have signed numerous agreements since 1997, yet observers say Lebanon has not implemented many of the accords as a result of Western pressure, primarily from the United States.
When we have certain factions in Lebanon that are cooperating with the U.S., then they become part of these sanctions, which are being imposed by the U.S. On the other hand, Iran wants to provide assistance to all Lebanese people. The fuel or gas that reaches Lebanon would not be for one sect or one community, but for all Lebanese, especially when they are all suffering a total blackout.
In 2012, Iran presented an offer to the Lebanese authorities under which Iran would provide fuel for electricity in a period of 6 months initially, while the Lebanese government could make down payments in Lebanese lira. Abdollahian later held separate meetings with Speaker Nabih Berri and caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati and discussed the latest developments in the region and ways to improve bilateral ties. Earlier, the Iranian minister also met with Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah and discuss the latest developments in Lebanon and Palestine, especially the threat posed by the Israeli regime. Iran's foreign minister stressed that the Islamic Republic will remain a good friend of Lebanon in hard times, but it seems Lebanon has been forced by foreign powers to turn down unconditional help during the most difficult juncture in its economic history. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Ukrainian officials say that Russia has carried out a missile attack on the capital, Kyiv, targeting critical infrastructure. Officials say a series of explosions hit the capital's Dnipropetrovsk district. Now, that prompted air raid sirens across Kyiv, with people urged to take shelter. The presidential office says damage to facilities is being investigated. Russia has been pounding Ukraine's vital sectors, including its power grid, with missiles and drones since October, causing blackouts and disruptions. Latest attack comes a day after Russia announced the seizure of Soledar, a salt mining town in the eastern region of Donetsk. The Russian Defense Ministry called the victory a key step in its offensive. So Dadar has been a hot spot of fighting for days, with both sides admitting heavy losses. Now Sweden takes over the rotating presidency of the European Union with a vow to oppose Russia and support Ukraine. Critics say the EU's foreign policy towards Moscow is set to backfire even more this year. Jerome Hughes reports out of Brussels.
Stockholm's government has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union. It holds the position for the next 6 months and faces many challenges. Amid the conflict in Ukraine, the powers that be in Moscow have been singled out.
This is the peaceful order that the Putin regime now seeks to destroy. But we will defend it here and in Ukraine and everywhere.
Many analysts say the EU has shot itself in the foot by provoking and isolating Russia at Washington's behest. Accommodation, food and energy prices remain extremely high in the EU. The European Parliament has just published results of a survey which shows cost of living is the number one concern for citizens.
Of course, I'm looking to go in and buy my own house at the moment. That's bit difficult to decide. Is it a good time? Is it not a good time?
Is the reliance on food banks is shocking. Even for people in full-time employment, like police officers, teachers.
For instance, Brussels, I think, is the city of trainees, of interns who try to start your career. And, for instance, you can have an internship that is not paid, then what you do?
The EU has sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine during the past 10 months, mostly to provide deadly weapons. Critics say the West wants to feed the arms industry and then make huge profits for Western companies when it finally comes to picking up the pieces.
We are preparing for Ukraine's reconstruction. The international donors platform that we set up with our G7 partners will be up and running this month.
Anti-war activists say many problems could have been averted if Moscow's security concerns had been listened to by NATO and the EU. Tourism industry representatives are asking the European Commission to intervene because in some EU countries, one-third of all rooms being offered by hotels and guest houses are currently being occupied by Ukrainian refugees. There's concern the bloc's tourism sector will be decimated this summer if the issue is not resolved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Peruvian President Dina Boluarte has defied calls for resignation after weeks of protests, citing her commitment to the country.
Some voices coming from the violent and radical groups demand my resignation, bringing people to chaos, disorder and destruction. I tell them in a responsible way, I will not step down. My commitment is with Peru and not with this tiny group that is hurting our homeland.
Boluarte also rejected calls to dissolve Congress, citing lack of legal condition, but she apologized for dozens of deaths caused during the protests. The president demanded an inquiry into the types of guns used to shoot at protesters. She said that those guns are different from the ones used by police. Peru's attorney general has already launched a probe into the deadly clashes. Those rallies broke out in December following the ouster and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo. He's in pretrial detention for attempting to dissolve Congress to avoid impeachment. The protesters want his release. And Brazil's far-right ex-president, Jair Bolsonaro, who will be investigated over January 8th attacks on government buildings in the capital, Brasilia. Now, investigation will focus on the origins of the insurrection. A Supreme Court judge says Bolsonaro will be probed in response to a request by the Office of the Prosecutor General. Office has cited a video that Bolsonaro posted 2 days after the riots. In that video, Bolsonaro had questioned the regularity of the 2022 election won by his leftist rival, Ignacio Lula da Silva. Prosecutor General Office said by publishing that video, Bolsonaro would have publicly incited the commission of a crime. He says that even though the video came after the riots, it may serve as a connection justifying the probe into acts by Bolsonaro before and after the attacks. The former president has denied any involvement. U.S. police brutality takes another victim. Unarmed African-American Keenan Anderson dies just hours after repeatedly tasered and restrained by Los Angeles police following a traffic accident. Now, Anderson, a 31-year-old teacher and father, was also a cousin of Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors. Anderson went into cardiac arrest several hours after the encounter on January 3rd. Los Angeles police released body cam footage of the incident after public outcry. They said that Anderson tried to run away after the car crash. Cause of his death has still not been officially determined. Black Lives Matter movement says Anderson was killed by police. His death brings to three the number of people killed in encounters with Los Angeles police in less than a week. Police brutality against people of color is a source of concern in America. Earlier, we spoke to co-founder of the Black Agenda Report, Margaret Kimberly, on the police killings in America and the cause of so much police violence.
Well, this past year, in 2022, there were more than 1,100 police killings, an average of three people every day. On average, one of those persons will be black and two are not. But we have this country where it is acceptable. There's no point in sugarcoating it, where the police have this power over our lives, and it's more than 1,000 people a year. We have a culture that's violent, that's militarized, and there's no way for that not to trickle down to policing and the way that it's carried out, where the police, police as a verb, black people all the time, no matter they can have an accident. There's some people say he actually asked for police assistance after a car accident. It wouldn't be the first black person to die after calling for help, but the nature of policing is such that incidents like this, deaths like this, are inevitable.
Inflation in the U.S. continues to be painfully high for the average household and shows no signs of returning to normal anytime soon. Washington appears committed to the highest interest rates and near recession levels of growth. Rami Mazahiri has your story from Chicago.
The United States' inflation rate has become the world's most important economic data point and will probably remain so until American inflation falls below 3%. That seems far away. As new data showed, inflation is more than double that at 6.5%, with the price of services increasing by the greatest rate in 40 years and the price of shelter increasing the fastest in nearly 30 years. The data means that American bankers and their banker allies in the European Union, the British Commonwealth, and various client regimes will continue with their unprecedented hikes in interest rates. The goals of the hikes, led by the nation's top banker, Jerome Powell, all seem to increase the burden on the average worker. Difficulty in borrowing means reduced business, and that means mass layoffs, which have already started in the tech and high finance sectors.
His answer is the need for an increase in unemployment, you know, which is worse than the actual cause of inflation, right? Like, your answer is worse than the actual cause, and also, not only that, likely won't even fix the issue.
Another aim is to willfully create a recession, which is the primary means of taming inflation in Western capitalism. Expectations are that the U.S. growth rate could drop to as low as 0%, which would essentially be a double-dip return to recession, and especially if the price of oil increases. Another unstated goal appears to be wage reduction, despite the obviously harmful effects that would have on the average worker. Data this month showed that wage growth has slowed to its lowest level in a year and a half.
Wages have not seen any type of, you know, most people, even if you got a raise, because inflation is so much higher, you still took a pay cut. And I know that's true for me, and that's probably true for the bulk of working people.
While sanctions against Russia have backfired tremendously across the West, corporate price gouging is perhaps the biggest culprit behind inflation. In the last quarter, U.S. corporations posted over $2 trillion in profit, a $1 trillion increase from 2020. Many argue that the enormous profit margins are the result of exploiting consumer expectations of high prices to keep prices elevated. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Japan's prime minister has called on the U.S. and Europe to act in unison with Tokyo against China as a key challenge. Fumio Kishida says his country will never allow any attempt by China to unilaterally change existing international order by force. Kishida also says Tokyo remains concerned about China's military activities in the East China Sea and will reinforce its deterrence. Kishida, who was visiting the U.S., earlier met the country's president, Joe Biden. During that meeting, Biden said that Washington remains committed to its alliance with Tokyo and praised Japan's recent announcement of its largest military overhaul since World War II. Earlier, Beijing slammed the U.S. and Japan for what it called their Cold War mentality and groundless attacks on China.
China urges the United States and Japan to abandon the Cold War mentality and ideological bias, stop creating imaginary enemies and replicating the mindset of the new Cold War mentality in the Asia-Pacific, and refrain from becoming countercurrents that destabilize the Asia-Pacific region.
Wang added the U.S. and Japan speak about promoting regional peace and security, but are rather seeking excuses for the military buildup and militarization. He made the remarks after the U.S. and Japan signed a defense agreement following talks between their foreign ministers and defense ministers in Washington. In the talks, they described China as the greatest strategic challenge in the Indo-Pacific and beyond. That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnants of gods on earth. Today's meeting has been very pleasant and useful. God willing, it will have abundant benefits for our future and our way of thinking. I'm very happy that we were able to hold this meeting this year. Last year, some women wrote a letter in the objection stating, "Why have you dedicated Women's Day to meeting with elegists?" They were right. Their objection was correct. Now, such a meeting does not necessarily have to be held on Women's Day. It is fine to hold it around the time of the birth anniversary of Lady Fatima al-Zahra. Now, we will continue to hold this meeting in the future as well, provided I am alive.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Up until this moment, this meeting has been exclusively devoted to women and has been overflowing with outstanding, excellent ideas. The talks given by the women here were very good, and I personally truly benefited from them. Of course, confirming what has been said after merely hearing it, read quickly over a microphone one time is not possible. One must reflect and think about these matters. So be sure to give me the notes. The woman who spoke without referring to any notes should write down the things she said too. This way, it will be both more precise, and I will have more time to think and ponder on it too. Also, I can give these notes to those who can study and think about these matters. Some recommendations were made. God willing, a solution will be found for these matters. Some of these suggestions may be related to the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution. These matters, they need to be discussed there or in other places, especially the issue of employing our intelligent, skilled, experienced, knowledgeable, scholarly, wise, perceptive women in different places in the country where decisions are made. This is an important matter.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The recent UN climate summit in Egypt offered more brazen hypocrisy than usual because the world's rich countries once again lectured poor nations about the dangers of fossil fuels as they continue to use massive amounts of new gas, coal, and oil. An African climate change activist speaks here on the sidelines of the summit.
We have had several conferences of the parties on the continent, at least four of them. Each time they say it's African COP, but at the end of the day, it doesn't have the aspirations, the decisions don't meet the aspirations of African people. So we decided this time to come as African people, as ourselves, and write our history and tell our stories ourselves. And what is the story? The story is that of a continent that has been treated unjustly for the last couple of years. The African continent as a whole emits less than 4% of the global gas greenhouse gases, and yet the impacts of climate change are felt more in Africa than anywhere else.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on hypocrisy and double standards by Western countries regarding the utilization of fossil fuels in Africa as Europe battles an energy crisis triggered by the conflict in Ukraine. Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Africa, a victim of climate change hypocrisy. At the 27th meeting of the Conference of Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or COP27,
held in Egypt last November, climate issues relating to Africa took center stage. Europe is facing an energy crunch, and countries in the continent are reopening coal plants. They are also actively looking to develop new sources of fossil fuel abroad, especially in Africa, where they had previously worked to block investments in the sector. Out of the 23 top investors in Africa's oil and gas projects, 14 are headquartered in the US, 6 in Europe, 1 in Canada, 1 in India, and 1 in South Africa.
Western countries that were calling for reduction of the use of fossil fuels before the Ukraine crisis are now financing fossil fuel expansion in Africa to fill the gap left by a halt of energy supplies from Russia. So even with Africa hosting the 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, many in the continent felt sidelined as Western industrialized countries dictated the agenda to reflect their geopolitical objectives. An activist who was frustrated at the COP27 summit speaks here.
I was so happy when they announced that COP will be in Africa, and I thought maybe we'll get a chance to be at the room where the negotiations are taking place. But today I can tell you I wasn't allowed to access the room. So I'm like, why are we here? Are we here to write around, or we are here for negotiations? So my worry is, even in Africa today, the COP is in Africa, but we have not been given a chance to speak. This is the one.
Now to discuss how Africa is a victim of climate change hypocrisy, we have contacted Nimo Bassey, an environmental activist and author. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thank you, Mohamed.
We also have with us Nefta Freeman of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Freeman.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's start off with Mr. Nimo Bassey. The COP27 climate summit held last November was dubbed the African COP due to its location in Egypt. Now, did Africa get the much-touted climate justice at this summit?
The short answer is Africa did not get any sense of climate justice from the summit. And secondly, calling it an African COP was very incorrect, because this was the fifth time such a conference was being held on the African continent, and none of it had ever been an African COP. So this was just a way to lull Africans to forget that this was a time to really fight for justice. I wouldn't get any of that at the end of the day.
The COP27 ended with what was branded a historic deal to create a new fund in which countries responsible for high carbon emissions will compensate vulnerable countries suffering from climate impacts. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, in a video message to COP27, said the conference has taken an important step towards climate justice, but insisted the step was not enough.
But let's be clear. Our planet is still in the emergency room. We need to drastically reduce emissions now, and this is an issue this COP did not address. A fund for loss and damage is essential, but it's not an answer if the climate crisis washes a small island state off the map or turns an entire African country to desert. The world still needs a giant leap on climate ambition.
COP27's loss and damage fund for developing countries has been termed a breakthrough. However, many critics insist that it is just another empty climate promise.
It wasn't by any means a breakthrough. It was just a little glimmer of what could actually happen. From what we heard before and after the conference, the rich countries, industrialized nations, who have caused global warming by their polluting activities, are unwilling to accept any sense of liability or to make the loss and damage a sense of climate reparation. What they want to make it seem like is just a token, like charity. But what the developing nations, the victims, actually need now is a climate debt, which the global north, industrialized nations, do owe. And they should accept and pay a climate debt, not just paying for loss and damage while the damage continues.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has criticized Western nations' agreement to allow some fossil fuel investment while blocking Uganda's rights to retrieve oil and gas for itself as purist hypocrisy. Now, do you agree with the EU's parliament opposition to Uganda's oil pipeline project?
Well, there are a lot of contradictory signals going around in the world. The Western nations are still investing heavily in fossil fuel extraction, while at the same time acknowledging the fact that this is what is driving global warming. For us in Africa, it's also a double tragedy because our nations need a lot of financial resources, and at the same time, many of our political leaders don't care to think about the harm that comes from fossil fuel extraction. The communities in the oil fields of Uganda are really suffering. Some are displaced, and their lives have been totally shattered. And financing cannot resolve that kind of issue. So I believe it needs a lot of rethinking from both ends, from both the Ugandan, the African people, and from those who are driving expansion of fossil fuel extraction.
Now, African countries argue that they must be allowed to benefit from their fossil fuel reserves, as rich countries already have done. Now, experts say African countries are exporting their fossil fuels due to misplaced priorities.
Africa needs energy. We are not selling energy outside because we don't need it. We are selling energy outside because we have misplaced priorities.
An interesting aspect of the fossil fuel politics is that in Africa, fossil fuel exploration is extremely focused on the needs of the West. Western countries just care for their needs and do not want to see these fossil fuels being utilized for the benefit of the people of Africa.
Obviously, the global North or the Western nations have been extremely selfish in their approach to other regions of the world. What we're seeing now is a fossil colonialism, where in Africa and other regions are just seen as places to extract resources for the comfort of the West. They are unwilling to realign their lifestyles and consumption levels to the realities demanded by the need to tackle global warming. And so we're seeing a situation where the harm continues, exploitation continues, our environments continue to be trashed. And although our governments may receive some foreign exchange, may earn some foreign exchange, this can never be exchanged to what we are losing to meet the needs of the West. And up to 89% of the infrastructure, for example, for extraction of gas on the African continent is all aimed for exports to the West. And this is ridiculous. The needs of Africa have to be considered. And that is not being done as at now.
Let's now bring in Naftali Freeman. Africa itself has a huge energy deficit, yet the continent's gas is mostly delivered to Western countries. Now, do you think the new dash for African gas is another manifestation of colonial exploitation?
Yeah, this is a disposition that is a legacy of colonialism. It is what characterized neocolonialism. In fact, it's not extends beyond the use of fossil fuels, but any type of raw minerals and things that are refined into finished goods that Africa has been used to supply the industrialized world with and make Western Europe rich and corporations and rich people rich. This extends to them. Their colonial mentality means that they want things for themselves, and they think that by virtue of domination and theft that they should be entitled to these things. Right now, we're seeing also the insatiable need of, fueling modern industrialization and the war machine when it comes to fossil fuels. So modern industrialized countries, they use more fossil fuel and oil and gas than any other countries, and they get all of that from other countries, and particularly in Africa right now. A lot of this is happening with Africa, and they fuel wars, and in fact they go to war for it.
Well, very well put there. The current fossil fuel politics is characterized by neocolonialism perpetrated by Western powers. We now take a short break before we continue with our topic for today on how Africa is a victim of climate change hypocrisy. Stay with us.
Africa, a victim of climate change hypocrisy.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Africa is a continent paying for the devastating effects of a climate change crisis it did not ignite. A Somali elder elaborates here on the horrific effects of climate change. Climate change is certainly having a catastrophic impact on many African countries. Now, should the development of Africa be put on hold until the climate crisis is over?
The short answer is no. But Africa has to determine what is the type of development, what is development, and where do we want to go? If we want to go the way of the West, that's the wrong direction to take, because we can see where that has led the world now. So the issue of extracting natural resources so as to develop Africa is not really true, because right from slavery to colonialism to neocolonialism, extraction of resources on the continent have always benefited elsewhere, the other, not the region. So it's a time to really re-examine. We have the concept, the philosophy, we know what we need, we know what the people in the community, our communities require. We know the African philosophy of development, of the good life, for example. What does it mean to live well? We need to do some inward looking. Otherwise, we always fall victim to this kind of exploitation, inequity, and injustices that we're seeing in the world today.
I will put the same question to Mr. Freeman. Now, do you think Africa should reduce or stop using fossil fuels due to pressure from Western industrialized countries?
Absolutely not. The development of Africa and no other places should be put on hold until the climate crisis is saved. It can only be saved with the development of some of these places. It's the overuse, the overconsumption, the misuse by the so-called developed countries that exacerbates the climate crisis. We have to also remember that all means of eradicating poverty are actually in contradiction with advanced late-stage capitalism, neoliberalism, and the Western world. So the things that need to happen for poverty to be eradicated are actually in contradiction or aren't antithetical to the different policies and developments or things that sustain the Western world and also at the same time exacerbate the climate crisis. So the only solution is for there to be people-centered movements for socialism, and they were talking about bottom-up movements where the global non-white working class and peasant classes depose white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy, and establish a system when we say people-centered and establishing a system that actually establishes real participatory democracy by those most impacted by these issues.
Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, says African countries are already forced to spend between 2% and 5% of their gross domestic product each year to deal with the climate change problem they did not create. This is one of the most shocking injustices against the continent.
While I don't lay much stock on measurements of the gross domestic product, I do believe that the figures being brought out by the chair of the AU actually underscores the fact of climate injustice that we all reject and campaign against. Africa is already being forced to bear the burden of tackling global warming by our forests, our resources being used either as carbon sinks or providing resources for energy for others and not for the continent. And this is something that requires real action by the African Union and other vulnerable regions who are suffering the same kind of discrimination, the kind of overloading of the responsibility of climate action. It's a time to call for a people's conference of parties and not just this routine ritual that keeps heaping more problems on the victims.
U.S. climate envoy John Kerry was quoted as saying that African countries should not invest in natural gas projects. Yet, in the space of just 6 years, the U.S. LNG industry has become the largest in the world, overtaking both Qatar and Australia. Let's take a listen.
Gas could be used as a transition. And we're not saying no gas. What we're saying is that over the next few years, gas replaces coal or replaces oil. That's good. But after 2030, it's going to be important to be able to capture the emissions from gas, too.
Can we say that this statement by Kerry aptly captured the political position by the imperialist powers?
Well, what I would really like to ask Mr. Kerry is, does that same statement apply to the United States, or does it apply only to Africa? We need a system, a situation where justice will require that Africa follows the pattern of development that maintains our environment, that keeps our culture, and that meets our aspirations, and that no one dictates to the continent what the continent must do.
The industrialization of Western countries was made possible by the exploitation of Africa's natural resources. Just as is the case surrounding the payments of reparations for African enslavement and colonization by Europe and North America, Western powers are not accepting responsibility for the harm done in the past or the present. During the COP27 summit, Kenyan President William Ruto expressed concern that industrialized countries have defaulted in their pledges to help mitigate climate disasters.
The pledge made 13 years ago in Copenhagen, committing US dollars $100 billion annually, remains unfulfilled. Such a gracious and unexplained default is a major cause of persisting distrust, and neither is there any sound reason for the continuing pollution. In stark contrast, Kenya, a country with far less resources than the average developed country, has foregone pollution industrialization and growth opportunities and intentionally invested in clean, green energy.
Do African countries have options in compelling industrialized countries to embrace climate justice and fulfill their pledges to financially assist poor countries that are bearing the brunt of climate change?
We have to remember that the different countries also have a class composition to them. So the industrialized country, I mean, we shouldn't only see it as the embodiment or the embodiment of it is only the interest of their ruling classes and their elite class. So in all of the industrialist countries, there is a dispossessed working class communities, a lot of them non-white, and even in the European countries, or it's particularly in the U.S. as a settler colony. What that means is that the only hope of reparations for, and which actually should be seen in a more sophisticated way. It's not just money payments, but the repair. Reparations is a repairing of the harms done to a people, that can only come, and particularly to African people, can only come with Pan-Africanism.
The bulk of exploration for new oil and gas resources in Africa is carried out and financed by foreign companies. Now, this has made African countries vulnerable to manipulation by Western powers. So what can Africa learn from Iran that has attained a high level of self-sufficiency in its fossil fuel projects?
Well, one of the main things it can learn is that it needs to stand up to imperialism. I mean, just to acquiesce to imperialism hasn't gotten the African countries and the comprador class, which is really serving themselves, anywhere. And in fact, another thing that it can learn from countries like Iran, but other countries, is that these countries are coming together and formations that would be a tantamount to a new non-aligned movement that we saw in the 50s and the 60s, where they are not. They're saying, well, we have to look at our own interests instead of being seen as only serving the interests of either, of global powers. Then we define our own interests. And in doing that, we also connect and cooperate and collaborate with other international countries to try to withstand the aggressions of imperialism. And so this is very important for African countries to understand.
Well, there you have it. African countries should be part of the new world order that withstands the aggression of imperialism. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. I would like to thank our guests, Nefta Freeman and Nimo Basse, for their incisive analysis. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. We have a very special guest speaker for today's program, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to continue our discussion regarding, we can say, whether the masculine or the feminine discourse is dominant in the text of the Holy Quran or not. In the previous discussions, we said that it is not so. And there are some specific, of course, exceptions and cases. But now for this episode, we want to get into some of the examples in the text of the Holy Quran regarding this topic. What are they?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned in the previous session, first of all, when it comes to the dominant discourse of the Quran regarding, spirituality, regarding the creation of man, regarding the intellectual understanding and potentials of human beings, there is no difference between men and women. I shared a couple of verses from the Quran, like chapter An-Nahl, verse 97, and chapter At-Tin, verse 4. We also refer to the fact that when it comes to Arabic language, it is a rule in Arabic grammar and Arabic syntax that when you have a group of men and a group of women and you want to address them all, you need to use masculine forms in the verbs, in the attributes, and in the pronouns. And that is why in most of the cases in which the Noble Book of Quran uses masculine form, it doesn't mean that it is exclusive to the men, rather it includes women as well. And in this regard, I also refer to chapter 33, verse 33, Ayatul Tathir, the verse of purification.
Yes.
And also, I talked to the fact that the Arabs at that time and even today, and not only the Arab, it's a common culture in among many peoples all around the world. They prefer to give a kind of dignity to women when it comes to addressing them.
That's right.
So when we are talking about some, delicate issues, which is not in line with the dignity of people, different cultures prefer not to mention the women, not
That's
to
right.
address women directly, rather just to mention men. Although, indirectly, that includes women as well.
That's right.
I refer to one verse in this regarding those people who cannot afford marriage because of poverty, in chapter An-Nur, verse 33. So Allah says that وَلْيَسْتَعْفِفَ الَّذِينَ لَا يَجِدُونَ نِكَاحًا حَتَّى يُغْنِيَهُمُ اللَّهُ مِنْ فَضْلِهِ. Allah is talking about masculine.
Mm-hmm.
Allah is using masculine form. الَّذِينَ لَا يَجِدُونَ يُغْنِيَهُمْ.
Yes.
In all these cases, all of them are in masculine form. So one way for this, one way to justify why masculine form is what I mentioned before, that when you have a group of men and a group of women, you need to use masculine form. But the other explanation by some scholars is that in these cases, it is against the dignity of such women to use feminine form as well, because the discussion is about marriage and those people who cannot afford
That's
marriage.
Right. So to say, in order to save the face and the honor of the
That's
Muslims
the
and the people in general, we could say the Holy Quran.
Yeah, and this That's can right. apply to many verses of the Quran
mm-hmm.
too.
Good.
Both points can be taken into consideration. The point that when you have a group of people, you need to use masculine form, and also the second point about the good culture of the Arabs. So many verses are in this regard. For example, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is reprimanding a group of people for some of their bad features, Allah uses only masculine form.
That's right.
So for example, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يُعْجِبُكَ قَوْلُهُ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا. There are a group of people that when they talk about this world, they do not talk in a good way. What you hear from them may surprise you. So
yes.
Allah is reprimanding the people who are somehow deceived by worldly pleasures.
Yes.
But in this case, only masculine pronoun is used. Although it could be وَمَنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَعْجُبَكَ قَوْلُهُ or qawluha aw qawluha, for example,
yes,
so that both men and women are included. But it is mentioned only in masculine form because of two explanations. The first one that I shared before, and the second one that I'm not that I'm explaining now, and that is the fact that to preserve the dignity of women when it comes to bad attributes.
Do we have any case in the Holy Quran in which the feminine and the women are referred to as with the men? Do we have such an exception or not?
With men, you mean?
Yes, no, yeah. Women are referred to, but they are referred as a man, for example, or with the, for example, masculine pronoun.
No, if the addresses are only women, mm-hmm, then we have feminine words and pronouns.
Okay.
For example, a couple of verses in chapter Ahzab are addressing the wives of the Prophet.
Uh-huh.
So all of them are in feminine form, in kuntunna, for example,
yes,
turitna, for
yes,
example. We know that some of the verses before Ayatul Tathir, they are,
yes,
addressing the wives of the Prophet.
Yes.
And all of them are in feminine form because,
yes,
no man is included.
Yes.
But as soon as verse 33 is mentioned, because of the fact that,
yes,
next to Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha, we have some men, the,
mm-hmm,
Prophet, Imam Ali,
yes,
and Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein Alayhi Wasalam, then we have masculine form.
So it
and
shows...
This is,
yes.
Sorry to interrupt
okay,
you.
Okay.
This is one of the reasons that,
yes,
the,
mm-hmm,
wives of the Prophet are not included in Ayatul Tathir.
And Ayatul Tathir does not refer to the wives of Prophet.
Not at all.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
and
what about examples?
There are some... So thank you for referring to that point. When there is a discussion for only women, for sure the Quran is using feminine forms. And
yes,
there are many verses in this regard. We have some verses about some of the Islamic laws, which,
mm-hmm,
are special for ladies. And of course, we have some verses which are talking about some special women.
Lady
like
Maryam, for example.
Maryam,
yes,
the wife of Fir'aun, for example.
Lady Asiya, yes.
So for sure, in all these cases, the feminine forms are used, like when it is the case for some of the men specifically, like Fir'aun himself, like, Ashab al-Fil, for example, and of course, good people like the prophets, then in that case, for sure, the words should be in line with the gender, male
right,
or female.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Also, we know that the Arabic language has used the masculine and feminine form for the things too, for the objects,
yeah,
in general, okay?
Yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that, for example, that thing is a feminine or masculine gender. But
yeah, we have the same in other Latin
languages
like French,
yes,
language as well. They
That's
also
right,
have it, yeah.
But for sure, there is, we can say, a philosophy, isn't it, of referring to, how can I say, there must be a philosophy behind using such pronouns in reference to the men and women in different parts of the Holy Quran. Is it, for example, to make them clear for the dear listeners, or we can say the readers of the text of the Holy Quran?
Yeah, you know, there are some verses in which, as I mentioned in the first point, when you want to address both men and women, you,
yes,
need to use masculine forms.
Masculine form, yes.
But in some cases, the Noble Book of Quran, we have some exceptions. In,
yes,
some cases, the Noble Book of Quran has mentioned both.
Mm-hmm.
Like the verse that I recited in the previous session, that those people who act righteously, ذَكَرٍ أَوْ أُنْثَى,
yes,
whether they are male or female. So
okay,
there is a point here. Allah wants to explicitly mention that there is no difference. Or, for example, in chapter An-Nisa, verse 32, لِلْرِجَالِ نَصِيبُ مِمَّا اكْتَسَبُوا وَلِلْنِسَاءِ نَصِيبُ مِمَّا اكْتَسَبُوا. We know that in the time of Jahiliyyah, the pre-Islam era of ignorance, the women had no right to possess anything. It was, through the advent of Islam that women came to be able to possess anything, something.
Yes.
So in this verse, Allah says that the man has a share from what they earn, And explicitly again, Allah repeats the same for women. وَلِلنِّسَاءِ نَصِيبٌ مِمَّا اكْتَسَبْنَ in feminine form.
Yes.
So this is because of the significance of the point, because to explicitly